Thank you very much, Claudine, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you for being here so early in the morning. So I'm going to talk about development information and causation. This is my email and this is my web page. So the first thing I want to say is that I'm not a specialist of causation, not at all a specialist of causation. In fact, I know nothing about causation. So I'm just going to focus on one aspect, which is, I think, very important for biologists and philosophers of biology, which is the specific case of development. As Claudine said, I worked mainly on immunology, and I'm not going to talk about immunology, and I've started working on development in the last 4 or 5 years. So I think that a very important question for biologists and for philosophers of biology is what causes development. So this is really one example in which the causal language and the causal issues are considered as crucial, very important. And this is so for biologists, of course, but this is also the case for philosophers, for human thought in general. So you just need to have a look at Aristotle, for instance, generation of animals, to see that it's a very important question for philosophy, and it's been so for a very long time. So I think that development can be defined as the construction of a novel organismal form. So this very rough idea that you start with something small, like an egg cell, and with some steps you arrive at something which is something like the beginning of an organism. So something which is very small and homogeneous, and something which is bigger and heterogeneous in the sense that it has organs, differentiated organs. In fact, this definition of development raises many important issues, and one of them is to determine when development starts and when development stops. And that's a very complicated issue from an ethical point of view, but also from a very straightforward scientific point of view. Okay, so the question is about the construction of a novel organismal form and the way we can explain this construction. Developmental biology is full of causal words, of a causal language. This is really something striking if you have a look here, for instance, at one of the main textbooks in developmental biology. So there's causality everywhere in development. And here are some examples of a single cell which gives rise to hundreds of different cell types. It produces, it generates, about morphogenesis, the idea of organization, division, migration, coordination. All this is the vocabulary of development. Just one last example, which is funny, I think. If each cell in our arms underwent just one more round of cell division, we could tie our shoelaces without bending over. Maybe it's a pity, but that's the way it is. How do our cells know when to stop dividing? How is cell division so tightly regulated? So all these ideas are really the main ideas in developmental biology. This is what we want to explain. And what is also very striking is that developmental biology is one of the main fields in which the idea of information and the notion of biological information has been used again and again. You find in development the idea of a developmental code, of a developmental program, of developmental information. And the main question I want to raise today is, what does information mean, in this context? And a very important question, I think, is information a metaphor for causation? I think that it is to a large extent, but I want to explore this idea. What does information mean, and is it a metaphor for causation? So here's the problem. What does the notion of information mean when it is applied to development? Does it capture some important aspects about the causality of development? And thirdly, how should developmental causes be understood? So here's the outline of my talk. First, I want to talk about developmental information and genes as information. Second, I want to examine the critique of the idea that genes give the form to the developing organism, inform the organism in the sense that it gives the organism its form. Then, in a third part, I will examine recent arguments that defend again the idea that genes are causally special. Genes are something special from a causal point of view. These are the idea expressed by Ken Waters in particular, as I will explain. So this is the third part, genetic causality strikes back, stability and specificity. And in the fourth and last part, I want to make a critique of this idea, a critique against recent views that genes are causally special. And I will raise the question of whether or not we should think about abandoning information talk in developmental biology. Okay, so I start with developmental information and genes as information. The question I want to raise at the most general level is the following. How is it that frogs so reliably give rise to eggs that so reliably give rise to frogs? That's the main question in developmental biology. Etymologically, in several languages, development means unfolding. And indeed, we tend to think of development as the unfolding of something which is already present, something which is already there, and that just have to unfold. And also, there's something which is already present in the embryo, or perhaps in the egg cell. This something is also transmitted from one generation to the next. So there is really this idea, with DNA in particular, that you have something which is transmitted, and that as soon as it is there, it's going to unfold and give you the form of the organism. The notion of information captures all these ideas. And in fact, there's at least two main aspects or dimensions about information, especially when we think about genetic information. The first idea is that information would be something intrinsically linguistic. DNA would be a language. And the second dimension is about information as something that gives the form giver, something which is already there and gives the form. So DNA is probably or has been considered as the best candidate for these two aspects. DNA would be linguistic, and DNA would be something already there in the egg cell, and it would unfold and give rise to the organism. Okay, so on this dimension, on this side, this idea of the form giver, there are several important dimensions. First, the idea that DNA would pre-exist. Also, the idea that DNA would be, to a large extent, autonomous. And thirdly, the idea that DNA would be, to a large extent, deterministic in its way of unfolding. So that's the right dimension. And the dimension on the left is the idea that DNA would be a code that would be decoded by the developing embryo. So I'm going to talk a little bit for a few seconds about this, and then I'm going to concentrate on this aspect on the right. Okay, so is it true that DNA is a linguistic code? The idea is that DNA sequences would constitute a message which would be transcribed into RNA and translated into proteins. And that's the very linguistic language that you find in developmental biology. Well, in a minimal sense, it is true that DNA should be seen as a code, at least as far as the primary structure of proteins is concerned, that is the linear sequence of the proteins. So you have, as everybody knows, 64 codons and 20 amino acids, and you can see here that as long as you know the different constituents of RNA, you can predict very easily what will be the amino acid. So is it a language? Well, it's not exactly a language. It's more like correspondence rules, so to speak. But this is indeed something that looks like, perhaps, a language. This is an idea that was first expressed by Schrödinger in 1944, and then, of course, developed in detail by Watson and Crick, and the whole idea was commented in this book about the history of the genetic code. Some people go further and say that DNA should be understood as letters, as words, and there would be bits and bits of information, as Richard Dawkins has it, and DNA would be a book and all these ideas. I don't think this is very helpful. I'm not sure Perhaps it was helpful. I'm not sure it's very helpful today to think about DNA in these terms. But at least there is some linguistic dimension in the idea of genetic information. But then there's a very different idea about the code or coding. And this is really a very different sense. That is the idea that for some people, genes code for proteins, in the sense that they determine the sequence of the proteins. And that, to a large extent, is inadequate if you think about the tertiary structure of the protein. That is what the protein will be in three dimensions and what it is going to do. Some people suggest that genes code for the properties of the proteins. And some people suggest that genes code for the phenotypic traits of the organism. And that surely is, to a large extent, inadequate. Anyway, what I want to say is that here, coding for, has in fact become a way to talk about determination and not anymore about language. What I mean is that from code to coding for, we've been from the left side, and from the left side, we went to the right side. We, in fact, talking about determination when we are talking about genes coding for proteins or phenotypic traits. So there is this kind of translation of meaning here, which I think is part of the problem. Part of the difficulty with the notion of genetic information is that a linguistic metaphor has been used implicitly to suggest a causal metaphor, that is, a metaphor that concerns the causality of development. So now I want to concentrate on this, on the causal aspects, on the idea of pre-existent closure and determinism. This side, the right side of information talk, has directly to do with causality. Probably the best candidate to capture the three aspects you find here, pre-existent closure and determinism, is the idea of a genetic program of development. So we'll examine the concept of genetic program of development and then its relation to the idea of biological information. So what is the idea of a genetic program of development? François Jacob is certainly one of those who emphasized with most insistence this idea of a genetic program. In 1981, he writes, "For modern biology, every living being is formed by the execution of a program written in its chromosomes. The chromosomes of a fertilized egg contain, written in the DNA, the plans that direct the development of the future organism, its activities, its behavior." And the same idea are expressed in another book in 2000 by François Jacob. Another very important example, and I don't want to be too much friends-centered on this, but this is really the two people, anyway, I'm more criticizing than praising, so I don't think it's a problem. But this is really the two guys who played the key role in this idea of a genetic program, and to a large extent about genetic information. And Mono talks about, autonomous determinism about the development of the organism, and that's very striking. A living being structure owes almost nothing to the action of outside forces, but everything from its overall shape down to its tiniest detail to morphogenetic interactions within the object itself. It is thus a structure giving proof of an autonomous determinism, precise, rigorous, implying virtually total freedom with respect to outside agents or conditions, which are capable, to be sure, of impeding this development, but not of governing, guiding it, not of prescribing its organizational scheme to the living object. So that's a very strong claim about DNA as being what gives the form in a deterministic and autonomous way. And of course, I'm not saying that biologists today think that way. I'm going to get back to this. But I think that these ideas are extremely important to understand the notion of genetic information. Okay, the same idea is found in S. Meyer, several texts, in Wolpert and Lewis, in a very beautiful text, 1975, and more recently by the philosopher of biology, Alex Rosenberg. The genes literally program the construction of the Drosophila embryo in the way the software in the robot programs, etc., etc. So is there such a thing as a genetic program of development? And more generally, the idea has been expressed from the 1960s onwards that DNA should be singled out. And what I want to ask is, whether or not DNA should be singled out when we're talking about the causality of development. So why would DNA be singled out? Because it would be autonomous or largely autonomous in the unfolding of the program we just described, and or it would play a special, indeed unique role in development. And I think these ideas are very important still today. So two questions. Is DNA autonomous? And does it play a special role in development? Does it play a role that other factors cannot play in development? In what sense could DNA be special? Well, it could be special in the sense that DNA could be more causally relevant. But also, it could possess features that single it out among causal relationships. And this is related to recent work by James Woodward Ken Waters, I'm going to describe later on about stability and specificity in particular. So the idea is that the notion of genetic information would capture these different spatial features of this idea of autonomy, of being special, autonomous, etc. Okay, so this is my conceptual network, so to speak. Information is here. Information has a linguistic aspect that I described earlier. In many cases, the idea of information, and in particular genetic information, is associated with the idea that DNA would be the single cause for development, or the main cause, as I said before, for development. There is also this idea I mentioned before of pre-existence. DNA would pre-exist in a sense. The idea of closure, the idea of determinism. And these are more recent or more recently made explicit ideas about information and especially genetic information, stability and specificity in two senses, and I will go back to this later. So I'm mainly examining genetic information, and I want to ask several questions about this conceptual network. And what I will focus on, it's not surprising with regard to what I said before, is these four aspects: pre-existence, closure, determinism, and DNA being a single cause. Okay, so now I turn to the critique of the idea that genes give the form to the developing organism. The critique of the idea that genes inform the organism has several aspects. It is a critique of the idea of pre-existence. It is a critique of the idea of closure, of autonomy. It is a critique of the idea of determinism, and also a critique of the idea that genes would be the single or even the main cause of development. And indeed, we can say that the idea of biological information, in the sense that genes give its form to the organism, is largely a resurgence of preformationism. So here's Dick Lewington, one of the biologists I admire most, and he, he says, it is usually said that the epigenetic view decisively defeated preformationism. After all, nothing could seem to us more foolish than a picture of the tiny man inside the sperm cell, as in 18th century preformationism. Yet it is really preformationism that has triumphed, for there is no essential difference, but only one of mechanical details, between the view that the organism is already formed in the fertilized egg and the view that the complete blueprint of the organism and all the information necessary to specify it is contained there, a view that dominates modern studies of development. So if Dick Lewington is right, then preformationism is just the main view about development, at least in 2000. And I think this is very important to remember this time, even though we think that we are quite, you know, far from it, remote from it. I think that DST people, developmental system theory people, did a great job explaining this. So this is the case of Susan Oyama, of Griffiths, Gray, and also of people who do not really belong to the DST movement, but still made a critique of the idea that genes would inform the organism, especially developmental biologists Alessandro Minelli in The Development of Animal Form, a very, very good book. So here as the developmental system theorist, Susan Oyama, is Russell Gray and Paul Griffiths. By the way, she's a psychologist, he's a biologist, and he's a philosopher. So the idea that there would all be armchair philosophers, which is an idea that you find everywhere in the literature, is, I think, an idea we should be careful about. I mean, they are basically scientists, and then we can discuss about their ideas, but they are basically scientists. And Russell Gray is a wonderful scientist, I want to emphasize. Okay, anyway, what do these people do? The first thing is that they insist on opposite characteristics of development with regard to what I described before. They insist on non-preexistence. They insist on openness to the environment. They insist on contingency. They insist on multiplicity of causes with regard to development. They suggest, or they claim, that genes are not always more causally relevant than other factors in development. Well, sometimes genes are more relevant, but sometimes they're not. In many cases, for instance, phenotypic plasticity, the idea of reaction norms, though it is an idea which is disputable, environmentally induced phenotypes, all these cases show that in some cases, non-genetic factors can be causally extremely relevant. And the third idea, which is related to the former one, is that factors that influence development usually interact in very complex ways. In particular, the environment and genes interact, so much so that it is often very difficult and sometimes impossible, indeed, to separate genetic and environmental causes. In many cases, you just can't say if something is more genetic or more environmental, or purely genetic, or purely environmental. And the key idea, I think, is the last one. Nothing, from a causal point of view, is pre-existent. And I think this is the main point made by Susan Oyama, sometimes not well understood. The idea is that genes, indeed, pre-exist, in a sense, but not genetic causality. Hence, not genetic information. And that's the very idea of the ontogeny of information. So what does the ontogeny of information mean? Recall that it is the title of the book by Susan Oyama, published in 1985, second edition in 2007. The idea is that something becomes a developmentally relevant cause only in a context. For example, it is true that a stretch of DNA is already present, for instance, in the egg cell. But it becomes a cause only if it is activated by the cellular environment. Something as a gene becomes causally relevant only when it is activated. And most of the time, it is activated by a local environment, cellular environment, the maternal environment, an environment made of microbes, or a more general environment indeed. So even information itself has an ontogeny. Nothing looks like a pre-existent information. An information is constructed. And from that point of view, it means that the causality of development is always a product. It's always something constructed. Developmental information itself has a developmental history. The informational significance of any developmental influence depends on the state of the entire developmental system, including genes, the rest of the phenotype and relevant aspects of surround, and on the level and the type of analysis. I consider that these arguments are very convincing, and I consider that it's a major achievement of recent biology and philosophy of biology to have uprooted some of the idea I presented before, the idea of preexistence, the idea of closure, the idea of determinism. And I don't think we should downplay the importance of these people like Lewinton, Lehrman, Oyama, Griffiths, Gray, Strauss, Minnelli, and many others. So the conclusion is that genetic information cannot be linked to the idea of preexistence, closure, determinism, and DNA as a single cause. That's simply not true. This is not what genetic information can be. So the consequence is that we have criticized some key aspects of the notion of genetic information. But what about the others? What about the other aspects? Does the notion of information capture still some important aspects to understand developmental causality? The notion of genetic information is highly problematic, as I showed, with regard to pre-existence, closure, determinism, and DNA being a single cause, or the single cause, but perhaps not with such important aspect as stability and specificity. Recall my schema here. So linguistic is fine, or let's say roughly fine. The rest is simply wrong. It just doesn't work. But all this is extremely interesting. Stability, specificity. I'm going to explain what it means. So third part, genetic causality strikes back, stability and specificity. So here I use recent literature, especially Ken Waters' paper in 2007, a very influential paper, Causes That Make a Difference, and also work by Marcel Weber in 2006. And these guys, especially Waters, make use of James Woodward making things happen and his view about manipulationist account of causation. And all these ideas are commented, commented by James Woodward in this paper, Causation in Biology. I think that the key point is that the debate over biological causality has recently evolved. I agree with Woodward that the most appropriate debate nowadays is not about finding criteria for being a cause, but about distinguishing among causal relationships. And here the idea is that a cause, C1, could perhaps be more stable, more specific, and/or more proportional than another cause, C2. And here is the idea is not that C2 is not a cause, that it is not truly a cause. It is a cause, but it is maybe less stable, specific, and/or proportional than C1. And I think that the idea of distinguishing among causal relationships is something that could be extremely interesting. And perhaps DNA is something which is more stable, more specific, and/or proportional than other factors influencing development. So Waters' strategy can be seen as an attempt to maintain that DNA is, after all, special, but on the basis of new or refined arguments. And of course, that, if I may say, makes a big difference. Fair enough, I would say, but it should not hide former debates. What I mean is that, to some extent, Waters and others have suggested that the debates about the causal relevance of genes was not a true debate, was not a real debate in biology and philosophy of biology. And this is not true. For long, biologists did say that DNA was the main cause of development, and the rest was merely background condition. If nobody believes that anymore, that's good news. But I think this is so because some people made the kind of critique I presented before. So I want to suggest that what these people did was extremely useful, even though now we could consider that, you know, nobody believes this anymore, which, by the way, is something which is quite disputable. But doing as if this had never been the real debate, as Waters sometimes seems to do, is, I think, unfair and inaccurate. In addition, a new defense should not be based on a caricature of some thesis, especially the parity thesis, which is one of the main ideas of DST people, which is often presented with the Kitcher's version of it, which is, to say the least, not exactly a version in which DST people recognize themselves. So what are the new arguments in favor of the idea that genes are causally special? This is what I want to examine. Perhaps genes are special, after all, from a causal point of view. Waters' thesis is that DNA is a specific difference maker in the sense that different changes in the sequence of nucleotides in DNA would change the linear sequence in RNA molecules in many different and very specific ways. So what does specificity mean here? As James Woodward explains, the idea is that fine-grained changes in A induce fine-grained changes in B, and that, again, would make a difference. So DNA would do that. Small variations in DNA would induce small variations and fine-grained variations, in the RNA sequence, for instance. And this could be contrasted, according to Ken Waters, with the way RNA polymerase influence the RNA linear sequence. Of course, RNA polymerase is indispensable for making a messenger RNA, for instance. but it is just indispensable. It's not a fine grain influence on this RNA. So Waters does not argue in favor of genetic information per se, but the features of causality on which he insists are precisely those that are very important components of the notion of biological information. And as Woodward again emphasizes, there is a direct link between the notion of biological information and the idea of causal specificity. Biologists, I quote a footnote of the 2010 paper, biologists tend to think of structures as carrying information when they are involved in causally specific relationships. So is it true that genetic causes are specific and or stable? Well, yes and no. The influence of genes is often, though not always, specific. That is, fine-grained changes in A induce fine-grained changes in B. So it is often the case, at least if the effect being examined is the protein sequence, what we have called the primary structure of the protein. If you have a look at the tertiary structure, that is really what the protein is going to be, that's less clear. But from this point of view, it is at least often specific. Then the influence of genes is sometimes, though in fact very rarely, stable. That is, the idea of stability is the idea that something would hold when background conditions vary. And as several people have emphasized, the stability of genes is very relative, so to speak. So, okay, it seems that, at least for Ken Waters, the job has been at least partly done. DNA is specific, and that would make a difference. Or DNA is sometimes specific, and that would make a difference. And what we can also say is that even if DNA causes, most of the time, are not stable, maybe it's very interesting to emphasize the cases in which DNA is causally stable. For instance, with diseases, it could be important to localize the few cases in which, when you express one gene, you have the disease. That's, in fact, very rare, but that could be very important. So it could be, again, useful to use this notion of specificity and stability to distinguish among causal relationships. So is it true that genetic causes are more specific and or more stable than other causes that impinge on development? So here the question is, can we say that the influence of DNA is more stable, is more specific than the influence of other factors that influence development? And here my answer is no, roughly, and this is what I'm going to explain in the last part of my talk. Critique against recent views that genes are causally special, the end of information talk, question mark. The idea is that several non-genetic factors play a crucial role in development. That's the first and one of the main ideas. In particular, I'm going to show that symbiotic microbes play a crucial role in development. In addition, I'm going to suggest that non-genetic factors can express stability and or specificity. And I will conclude that genes cannot be singled out for any of these aspects. Many environmental factors play a key causal role in development. And one fascinating example that has been explored in the last 10 years mainly is the case of developmental symbiosis. In fact, in many living things, symbiotic entities are truly indispensable for a normal development. So this is an idea I developed in my book, The Limits of the Self, and in this paper, A Mixed Self, The Role of Symbiosis in Development. And what I'm going to show is that at least some of these symbiotic interactions are indispensable, stable, and or specific. So I'm going to present very briefly one of the most fascinating cases in these study about the importance of symbiosis in development. It became kind of a model about what I'm going to talk about. So this is the case of a small squid that is found in Hawaii, a Primna scolopis. It's 2 or 3 inches long, a very small thing, and it's a very interesting animal. The squid hunts at nights, of course in the sea. It emits light from its belly, And this light, very strikingly, mimics the moonlight, and thus it enables the squid to hide itself with regard to potential predators. So instead of having its shadow, which is visible, it's invisible thanks to this light organ. And what has been found 15 years ago, roughly, or 10, is that this light results from the mutualistic relationship between the squid and the bacterium Vibrio fischeri, a very specific bacterium. In exchange, so to speak, the squid furnishes carbon and nitrogen to the bacteria. And what is very striking in this case is that the very organogenesis of the squid depends on these bacteria, symbiotic bacteria. The squid secretes mucus to attract the bacteria from the environment, and in fact, Vibrio is very rare in the environment. So first, the squid attracts all the bacteria which are around, and the bacteria enter, and then the squid say, no, 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 you're not going to enter. And it selects less than 0.1% of the bacteria and say, no, I just want Vibrio fischeri. And it works very well. So there's a true selection of the bacteria, and it keeps only the bacterium Vibrio. So this was explained very well in his paper. So here's the light organ, and this organogenesis is truly dependent on recruiting this specific bacterium. This is an immature light organ, just the beginning of its morphogenesis, and here is the light organ with the bacteria. And I want to emphasize that this work has been mainly done with other people, of course, by Margaret McFungi, who is a wonderful biologist at the University of Wisconsin, and in a series of papers explained very well this influence of symbionts on development. So what is interesting for me is that the causal influence of the Vibrio bacteria on the squid Primula scolopes is first indispensable in nature. Squids won't survive without the bacterium. And it's also extremely stable. It holds when other factors, background conditions if you will, are modified, including temperature, solidity, presence of different other bacteria in water, etc. This was shown very recently in this paper in Evolution and Symbiosis. It's also very specific, but I'm not going to go into the detail here. I just want now to take another example, maybe an example which seems closer to us, that is us. In this sense, I mean mammals, mice and humans. So as you certainly know, you are made of 90% of bacteria and only 10% of eukaryotic cells. So you're mainly bacteria, and the same is true of me, of course. The idea is that from a genetic point of view, we are made of 99% of bacterial genes, only 1% of, let's say, our genes, or what we would have called before our genes. These bacteria are very numerous. We don't know exactly, but perhaps around 1,000 species, and only 7% of them have been cultivated in the lab. The relationship we have with our gut bacteria is a mutualistic one. And in fact, it should be described as an obligatory mutualism. 93% of the bacteria cannot live outside your gut, and you cannot live without your bacteria. You cannot digest, you cannot develop, you cannot have a functioning immune system. Symbiotic bacteria are indispensable for normal development. In particular, they are indispensable for angiogenesis, that is, the genesis of blood vessels in the intestine. And they're also indispensable for the organogenesis of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, which plays, of course, a key role. And what is also very striking from a manipulationist point of view is that changes in dietary induce changes in the gut bacteria, with possibly major consequences on the host. Actual manipulations have been done in mice and humans recently, for instance, in these two papers in Science. So the idea is that according to what you're going to eat, here a high-fat, low-fiber diet, here a low-fat, high-fiber diet, your bacteria are going to change. And they can change quite rapidly. Long-term consequences need some time, but they can change quite rapidly, as explained here. And according to what you eat, these bacteria are going to change, and your phenotype is going to change, possibly very rapidly. diseases or the kind of phenotypic characteristics that could be influenced by these bacteria. So, for instance, do not eat aspartame. I'm sure you know, but it has very quick and very strong consequences on the, your gut bacteria. And the consequences can be really consequences on the development of the host and on pathologies. So this relationship between symbiotic bacteria and the host is indispensable in nature, and it's also very specific in the sense that fine-grained variations in the symbionts induce fine-grained variations in the host. I just want to say very briefly that symbiotic associations were thought to be very rare in nature, and for now, 8 or 10 years, we know that they are everywhere. Symbiotic associations, says Gilbert in this textbook, symbiotic association, wherein the genes of one organism are regulated by the products of another organism, appear to be the rule rather than the exception. There are several other examples of environmentally regulated development. I'm not going to go in the detail. Here's an example, a famous example of predator-induced polyphenism. So you change your phenotype according of the presence of predators in the environment. So no development is autonomous. All development is co-development. All development is the co-construction of living things belonging to different species. Every organism is mixed, heterogeneous, not homogeneous. Every organism is impure. The organism is a unity of a plurality, and that's what is difficult to understand. How is it possible that we stand together, all the constituents of the body, so many of them coming from the outside, being foreign in a strong sense? What I want to emphasize again is that environmental factors can play a crucial, indeed strictly indispensable, causal role in development. They can be stable and they can be specific. So I agree much with the very recent book by Griffiths and Stotz, in which they provide several examples of non-genetic causes, in particular epigenetic regulations, that are stable and specific, and in that they answer to Ken Waters, accepting the notions of specificity and stability, but rejecting the idea that DNA would be special. What I've been doing today is to use other, more ecologically, I think, oriented example to reach an analogous conclusion. Just a quick note, to describe environmental influences on development, the term information is almost never used. In all this literature, people talk about dependence, regulation, contributions. They don't use the term information. So it's as if we used the term information when we thought that there was only one cause or a main cause. Nobody says that information is everywhere. Well, some people do, but I mean, nobody says it about these kind of interesting aspects. So why is the vocabulary about symbiotic bacteria not based on the idea of information? I think that as soon as we realized that information would be everywhere, we just dropped the idea. The word information is not used in this very important book, Ecological Developmental Biology. So can information be eliminated? And I'm going to finish with that. Back to our schema, we said that pre-existing closure determinism single cause were not adequate. I think that these ideas are indeed inadequate and misleading, the one I just presented. Other aspects, I think, capture important characteristics of biological causes, in particular stability and specificity. But the main idea I wanted to defend today is that these characteristics do not apply to genes only. So about genetic information, we have to say that these aspects here are important aspects of causality, though they are not criteria, and they can be true of DNA sequences, but not necessarily, and they can be true of other interactants, but not necessarily. But my suggestion is that even though these aspects are important, we should abandon the term information, because the ambiguities of the word information are such that it is much better to replace the word by more precise equivalence. I think that to a large extent, the idea of Sarkar is still true. There is no clear technical notion of information in molecular biology. It is little more than a metaphor that masquerades as a theoretical concept. I think that it's better to replace indeed the idea of information with other notions, more precise notions, asking about causal dependence, about stability, about specificity. And then what we should do, and what I've tried to do today, is to explore without any pre-notion that about the fact that only DNA would have these characteristics, we should explore many examples in biology to determine if they fit these notions or not. I conclude by saying that the notion of genetic information points to several aspects about the causality of development that are inadequate. The idea of pre-existence, the idea of closure, the idea of determinism, the idea of genes being the single cause of development. And I think I want to emphasize this once again, that it is a major achievement of biology and philosophy of biology to have uprooted these ideas. The notion of genetic information also points to adequate and very important aspects of developmental causality, and on this I agree totally with James Woodward. And yet, I think it's better to avoid the term biological information because, as I said, it mixes too many meanings and hence creates a lot of confusion. Thank you very much for your attention.